Yeah, I've got a little slideshow because I kind of figured that not that many people have actually seen the film. Can I? I'm just going to pretend this is like a normal seminar. Can I get a raise of hands who's seen the film? Really? Awesome. Brilliant. Well, either way, I've got some pretty pictures. Advance apology. My actual fancy DVD copy of this, for some weird reason, won't play on my computer. So I had to download, like, totally legally, it's all legit, download a version from the internet. So the screenshots that I've got here are a little bit dodgy. Anyway. My last little seminar thing. Ordinarily, I'd say, can we move to the front? But I'm not going to. It's all good. Okay. So the paper I'm going to be presenting today is it's really something of an interim piece, in as much as it ties together work that I've done in the past with research that I'm currently undertaking on the role of conditioning in contemporary continental philosophy. In a nutshell, what I'm going to be doing is looking at Alain René and Alain Robbe-Grillet's 1961 masterpiece, and it is indeed a masterpiece, I don't care what you say, Last Year in Marienbad, and I'm going to be doing it through a Badiouian lens, arguing in particular that the film's timeless nature, its enduring novelty in as much as its peculiar relation to time, ultimately results from its presenting what Alain Badiou would call an amorous event. I should also point out that there's a part two to this paper which goes on to examine the way that the film can be seen to condition Badiou's more recent philosophy, specifically his introduction of a logical phenomenology and his reconceptualization of the events. But unfortunately, that bit's still cooking. It's not quite ready yet, so we're just going to make do with part one for the moment. Also, this is going to be a slightly shorter paper than usual. It'll be around about 45 minutes, I think, with maybe 45 minutes questions or 1 minute questions. We'll see what happens. So we all get an early mark, as my teachers used to say. Okay, so she's my, yeah. Okay, so Alain René's cinema is as entwined with the question of time as are the lovers with each other in the opening scene of his and Marguerite Duras' 1959 also a masterpiece, Hiroshima Mon Amour. Just as Hiroshima's lovers are here disembodied and depersonalized in a sort of anonymous embrace, so too René's cinema can be seen to establish, I think, its own anonymous time, a timeless time, a time which is paradoxically removed or outside of time. Indeed, this is, I think, one of the more immediate ways by which we might understand Jacques Rivette's famous observation made at the time of Hiroshima's initial release back in 59, that René's work constitutes a parenthesis in time. Yes, John?
I was wondering, would you consider using a mic? Maybe?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Maybe.
Wait, hang on, wait. I think she just took control. Oh, yeah. No, that's fine. Any questions, incidentally, throughout, please, just shoot. Is this okay if I talk like this, or?
Yeah, she's okay.
I mean, if you'd prefer, I can go over and speak into the mic. It'll be very old school, but. Okay, all good?
Yeah, I quieted them down.
Okay, to recommence, I'll project. Okay, so I was talking about Jacques Rivette's observation that Hiroshima constitutes what he calls a parenthesis in time. So the parenthesis that Rivette's talking about doesn't simply refer to Hiroshima's ostensible circularity, whereby, as Rivette puts it, at the end of the last reel you can easily move back to the first and so on and so on, but rather highlights, I think, the film's timeless nature, its out-of-timeness. Now, it's this peculiarly untimely aspect of René's cinema that I want to examine in this paper, specifically with regard to his enigmatic and equally circular second film, Last Year in Marienbad. So drawing on the philosophy of Alain Badiou in particular and his concept of the events, I will argue, contra Gilles Deleuze, for example, who famously held that Marienbad captures the idea of time itself. I think he says this in Cinema 2 somewhere, quite a few times actually. So contra Gilles Deleuze, I want to argue that the whole of Marienbad is in fact situated in something of a temporal rupture, in the cut, effectively, between two heterogeneous times, namely a pre- and a post-evental time. Or again, I want to argue that the film's timeless nature results foremost from its presentation of what Badiou would call an amorous event. So, Poinet famously claimed that Last Year in Marienbad is an open film which proposes to everyone an experience, a choice. And indeed, the film remains to this day something of a puzzle. So Marienbad follows the story of a man and a woman who meet at a social gathering in a Baroque spa hotel. The man, X, they're just noted as... they're not even noted, they're not even given names actually in the film, it's just in the novel, so the man is X, anyway. Attempts to convince the woman, A, that they met and had an affair the previous year in Marienbad, or perhaps Friedrichsbad or Karlstadt. A claim that A steadfastly denies. Now, further complicating X's efforts to persuade A of their amorous past is the lurking presence of another man, M, who we presume to be A's husband, though this is never actually confirmed. So at the level of the narrative, the film thus revolves around a central enigma, namely whether or not X did in fact meet and have an affair the previous year. While the fact that this question ultimately remains unresolved has, rather unsurprisingly, been a point of consternation for many viewers, far more confounding, I think, are the experiments the film conducts at the level of its form. Indeed, Last Year in Marienbad is ostensibly organised around a series of repetitions where events, conversations, thoughts and actions are played out over and over, again and again, at times with really only very, very subtle variations. This repetitious theme extends as much to the central characters, who paradoxically replay an affair that may never have taken place, as to the hotel itself, which is depicted as an engulfing, labyrinthine structure of mirrors and Baroque intricacy, as we see. Maybe another one, actually. Yes. So Marienbad, that is the place, the film, the hotel, all of these things, accordingly presents something of a mise en abîme, its credo being, without doubt, repetition and reflection. It is, moreover, this peculiar structure that ensures Last Year in Marienbad is a film in which time appears to stand still, seemingly caught forever in a single instant that stretches on to infinity. Now, for those of you who have actually seen the film, I think you'll know what I'm talking about. It's a little bit hard to sort of tell with these. I mean, I've turned a film into a series of photographs, but anyway. So returning then to Rivette's early assessment of Hiroshima Mon Amour as constituting a parenthesis in time, we cannot help but be struck by the fact that his words proved to be even truer of René's immediately subsequent film Last Year in Marienbad. On this point, I think we'd do well to reconsider Rivette's final words on Hiroshima, in which he favourably compares René to the great Argentine writer Borges, inasmuch as, this is a quote, with René, it's the same notion of the infinitesimal achieved by material means, mirrors face to face, series of labyrinths. It is an idea of the infinite, but contained within a very short interval, since ultimately the time of Hiroshima can just as well last 24 hours as 1 second, end quote. So what interests us here is the fact that it's not Hiroshima, I think, but rather Marienbad, which can be seen to best capture the infinite in the instant, as Rivette would say. And thus, as Rivette puts it, can just as well last 24 hours as 1 second. As such, it is this second work, much more than the first, that I think constitutes a truly timeless film. For one thing, it is in René's second film that we quite literally encounter the Borgesian series of labyrinths and mirrors face to face of which Rivette waxes so lyrical. Suffice us to recall on this point the film's celebrated opening sequence in which a long discontinuous tracking shot drifts along labyrinthine corridors which the narrator enigmatically describes as endless, passing mirrors, mirroring mirrors, which is an effect. Actually, maybe just go back, sorry. Which is an effect that Rene intensifies later in the film by filming reflected and unreflected characters in the same shot to finally arrive at, what's what now? At a play which, in a really overtly metafilmic gesture, echoes the film itself together with the narrator's preceding monologue. You see that mise-en-abîme structure that just sort of doesn't really stop. Moreover, time is, I think, literally effaced in Marienbad in a number of very immediate ways. On a superficial level, we're never told in what period the action actually takes place, but rather can only infer from the character's dress and their environs, which the narrator enigmatically informs us belong to the past. Likewise, while one might suppose the film to be largely constructed of flash-forwards and flashbacks, this is never actually made explicit, as various discrete and frequently contradictory times where rooms seem to shift location, dress and decor alter inexplicably, incongruous events take place simultaneously. All of these strange contradictory times collide in a single and same present, seemingly defeating all hope of chronologization. And while this practice of simultaneously effacing and multiplying time might lead one to view last year in Marienbad as an atemporal or even heterotemporal film, I think it makes more sense to conceive of Marienbad as an intemporal or intertemporal work, as a work which operates between times. I'll explain that shortly, I promise. Indeed, as I'm going to argue, Marienbad situates itself entirely, I think, within a temporal rupture, in the very cut which cleaves one time from another, and as such can be seen to fall between plural times. So the film's intemporality thus results from its being paradoxically excluded from time while simultaneously straddling multiple times. Sounds confusing and odd, but to argue this, I'm going to have to say a couple of things about the philosophy of Alain Badiou and, in particular, his concept of the event. So I might just... I don't actually have any need for this slide. I just thought it was nice. Okay, so incidentally, there's sort of four sections to this, and that was section one, so section two. This section is called Appearing to Disappear, Badiou's Philosophy of the Event. So as many of you will probably be aware, Badiou's philosophy has garnered considerable currency in Anglophone academia in recent years. I'm just going to give a bit of background here. So while the inaugural English translation of one of his works only appeared comparatively recently, in 1999, the uptake of his philosophy since then has been very swift indeed, and today a respectable and ever-increasing number of his works are available in English, together with numerous collections of his writings, critical responses to his works, introductions to his philosophy, and so on and so forth. Now, the sudden upsurge of interest in his thought is due in no small part to the fact that, positioning himself squarely against postmodern orthodoxy, Badiou holds that we are in no way condemned to a world ruled by the principle of repetition, where novelty is reduced to so many extensions, recyclings, and superficial transformations of forms of knowledge that are already operating within the situation. Rather, Badiou holds that we are eminently capable of radical invention. Indeed, in Badiou's philosophy, true innovation is not only possible, it's the only thing through which we might truly live. So Badiou's philosophy is, at base, nothing short of a rigorous attempt to think novelty itself. At one end, a thinking of how something new and crucially universal arrives in the world, and at the other, of how real global change can come about. As he puts it in an oft-quoted interview with Bruno Bostils, quote, "My unique philosophical question, I would say, is the following. Can we think that there is something new in the situation? Not outside the situation, nor the new somewhere else. But can we really think through novelty and treat it in the situation? The system of philosophical answers that I elaborate, whatever its complexity may be, is subordinate to this question and to none other." End quote. So key to this decidedly novel philosophy is Badiou's concept of the event. So an event, roughly speaking, is a localized and entirely unpredictable rupture within the order of things, involving the sudden arrival on the scene of a radically new element, an element whose address is, for complicated reasons that I won't go into here, immediately universal. A single spark that ignites a political revolution, a new scientific theory compelling us to change our understanding of the world, an amorous encounter that turns your life upside down, a formal innovation which forces us to reassess the limitations as much as the possibilities of art. Suddenly and unpredictably, something happens in the world, ruptures with its prevailing logic by pointing to a previously unimaginable possibility, something which had hitherto been considered impossible or unthinkable, as opposed to simply unconsidered. Yet, in spite of its potentially momentous effects, an event proves to be as rare and fleeting as it is fragile. A paradoxical puncture hole in the fabric of the world, an event, if left unattended to, is all too quickly patched up by the forces that dominate and govern the situation, forces which Badiou terms the state of the situation, and which essentially establish a regime of repetition, in as much as what there already is, i.e. the situation of knowledge as such, can generate nothing other than repetition, i.e. it cannot think the new, or again, it cannot think tout court. Now, in interrupting repetition, which is supposedly what an event does, and thereby rupturing with the situation, an event thus marks itself out as a fundamentally illegal occurrence, whose fate, as such, is to vanish as soon as it arises. As Badiou puts it in his recent Logics of Worlds, an event, or more precisely, an event's material support, called its site, is, quote, an ontological figure of the instant. It appears only to disappear, end quote. As such, if an event is to have any durable effect, if it's to bring about any real and lasting change in the world, its happening must be in some way affirmed by an outside party. So this affirmation, together with the radical possibilities it implies, constitutes the trace of the vanished event, meaning that even though the laws of the situation dictate that the event itself must disappear, it nevertheless has to leave behind a trace, a mark of some description. So the process of affirming or tracing an event, however, proves to be somewhat of a tricky business. For as it turns out, we cannot, strictly speaking, know whether an event has taken place or not. The reasoning behind this is once again a little bit complicated, but essentially boils down to the fact that the place in which an event takes place, namely the voided part of the situation, the site of sort of radical inappearance, is a point which, for structural reasons, must remain altogether unrecognized by the state. To this end, there can be absolutely no knowledge of an event's occurrence, for the simple reason that, in falling outside of the statist order, which is equally the order of knowledge, so again, in falling outside of knowledge, it's thereby subtracted from all predication. Moreover, an event's being radically unknown means that its very happening must be, properly speaking, undecidable. Someone must make a, what Badiou calls, a pure decision regarding its having taken place, the purity of this decision residing in the fact that there can be, obviously can be no criteria upon which to base a decision concerning the occurrence of something which is radically unknown. Okay, so to summarise just this little part here, an event is, according to Badiou, something that happens, something that interrupts repetition in order to introduce something truly new in the form of a heretofore unimaginable possibility. So an event really is just a possibility. However, an event's radically unknown status means that its occurrence is in fact undecidable. With regard to deciding an event's having happened, as Badiou puts it, it is simply given to us to bet. There's just one last characteristic of the event that's of particular interest to us here, namely the event's paradoxical relation to time. So, as we've seen, or as I've just said, the ontological illegality of an event means that its appearing effectively coincides with its disappearing, inasmuch as it has to vanish the moment it appears, it arises. Yet while this necessary vanishing means that the event itself is essentially or effectively excised from time, this is in no way to say that an event has no temporal effect. To the contrary, and this is really important for Badiou, an event literally splits time in two. Or more specifically, what an event does is interrupt one time to introduce a new time, to which he gives the name eternal present. I'll quote him here. the event extracts from one time, this is from Logics of Worlds, the event extracts from one time the possibility of another time. This other time, whose materiality envelops the consequences of the event, deserves the name of a new present. So the event is neither past nor future. What it does is make us present to the present. So an event, oh, that's the end of the quote. So an event ultimately signifies a pure cut in time, which is itself necessarily cut out of time, leading Badiou to variously describe the event, and I'm just quoting from a whole bunch of books here, as an interval of suspense, a separating evanescence, an atemporal instant, an anonymous flash, etc., etc. So the event itself, this separating evanescence, thus vanishes between two radically heterogeneous times, namely a pre-eventual time and a post-eventual time. Okay, so what I want to do now is go on to argue that last year in Marienbad, as I was saying before, sort of situates itself, I think, entirely within this properly intemporal space, i.e. the space of the event. So this next section, that was section two, is called An Eternal Encounter, which I think is a bit of a crap name, so I'll think of something better later. So I think the best place to recommence our examination of time in last year in Marienbad is paradoxically enough with the question of movement. For the elliptical nature of Marienbad is not, I think, limited to time, but equally, and in fact perhaps even more immediately, registered in the film's movement, which is at once incessant and directionless. Indeed, Marienbad's many movements, be they in camera or of the camera itself, are characterized foremost by their possessing neither beginning nor end, being contrarily caught up in a kind of interminable passing, a passing which exists exclusively in the present without past or future. Suffice to recall Marienbad's opening shot, in which the camera drifts perhaps aimlessly, perhaps pointedly, along endless corridors in a seemingly eternal movement, which, as Francois Regnault might say, ultimately becomes reflexive of the film itself. In fact, I think I might take a quick pause here to show a little snippet of the film, just a bit of the opening sequence. So I might just run over. Okay, so, excuse me, so the endless sort of nature of this movement, it goes on for like another few minutes, and then basically the whole film is kind of almost a variant on it. So the endless nature of this movement is, I think, further underscored, of course, by the narrator's circular monologue, which repeatedly fades in and out of existence mid-sentence, as though caught in some kind of infinite loop, ensuring that we're forever held back from knowing where the words began or where they ended, where they might end. Now, the interminable and, I think, fundamentally immobile or static character of this movement, which incidentally equally extends to a physical immobility, the hotel guests having a peculiar and rather unnerving habit of freezing mid-action only to reanimate moments later, might lead one to suppose that Marienbad presents us with an image of purgatory, if not hell. Indeed, the ghostly pall surrounding the characters as much as their environs would seem to support this idea. If we recall Marienbad's... iconic shot, of the garden where the characters cast shadows but the trees don't. For my part, however, I want to suggest that Marienbad is, to the contrary, foremost a film about life, about the amorous encounter, which is really nothing other for Badiou than the intervention or the invention or the event of love. Indeed, what is last year in Marienbad, if not the attempt... Sorry. I didn't quite mean that, actually. What is last year in Marienbad, if not the sort of internal encounter, amorous in nature, of X and A? So the endlessness, I think, of this encounter lies not so much in its being infinitely repeated or denied, forestalled, postponed, etc., etc., as in its being undecided. Did A and X actually meet last year in Marienbad, or Friedrichsbad, or Karlstadt, or wherever? And did A agree to leave M for X? This undecidability equally holds for the film's violence. Did X rape A? Did M kill A? All these questions and more, which the film, of course, steadfastly refuses to answer, are, I think, but subsidiary effects of Marienbad's central undecidable event. Are X and A in love? Simply, inasmuch as Marienbad is, as I contend, wholly contained within an amorous event, the only escape, the only way the film might truly end, must be through a truly decisive act, i.e. in deciding the undecidable. So either X and A are in love, or they're not. One of the masterstrokes, I think, of René's film, and also one of the indicators of its supposed eventness, is the fact that this decision belongs as much to us, i.e. the spectators, as it does to X and A. So let's take an example. This central ambiguity, I think, is really beautifully mirrored in the statue of a man and woman, which is observed by X and A in the garden, a statue which, as X notes, could as easily be of themselves. And indeed, the characters are referred to throughout as statues. In fact, René's biographer, one of his biographers, James Monaco, even went so far as to describe Marienbad as an opera of statues. I might actually just change slides. Thanks. So with this statue, is the man holding the woman back, protecting her from some hidden danger? This is X's position, this is his statement. Or is the woman contrarily urging him onward towards something breathtaking? This is A's, the woman's position. Needless to say, neither X nor A can agree, and after their lengthy exchange on the subject of the statue in the garden, when A abruptly shifts to a different locale, the characters no longer regarding the statue itself, but rather its representation. Sorry, I've actually cut it off a bit here, but nonetheless. Its representation in a map of the grounds, which incidentally equally mirrors the removed position held by the Marienbad spectators with regard to the text's central undecidable, while the same conversation, or perhaps a variation thereupon, ensues. Now, it's at this point that M, the possibly villainous character who I foregrounded earlier, makes his reappearance so as to clarify the situation, authoritatively stating that the statue depicts Charles III and his wife at the oath before the Diet, immediately prior to his trial for treason. So M, who here I think clearly embodies what Badiou calls the state of the situation, thus attempts to reinscribe the unknown back into the field of knowledge. Yet M's explanation ultimately fails altogether, fails to touch on the undecidable content of the statue, namely the truth of the figure's inactions or actions. Moreover, his story is a fabrication. As Lynn Higgins points out, although the three historical markers given, Charles III, an oath before the Diet, a treasonal trial, although they sound authentic enough, there is no such historical personage. M's intervention is fiction invented out of historical materials, a historical discourse without historical reference. In Badiouian terms, M's deliberate untruth reflects the fact that statist or static knowledge cannot account for the undecidable. Hence, I think, the dreamlike, illogical structure of Marienbad. For in situating itself firmly within the amorous encounter, i.e. in the undecidable event itself, Marienbad effectively subtracts itself from knowledge. It is, I think, precisely for this reason that Marienbad appears to this day as something of a perplexity, a mystery with no real solution, or, if I can put it this way, an enduring novelty. As René himself puts it, Marienbad is an open film which presents us with a choice. It's not a film to be known, but rather one to be decided. Still, what is the source of this ambiguity, of this undecidability? Clearly, it arises from its frozen nature, from its having been ripped out of time, M noting that the statue is, of course, not of the period, to persist in another time. The insistence of time, of course, being a fundamental rule of cinema, a film always passes. This, of course, equally applies to the lovers, the statue, and the image itself. Plucked out of time, immobilized, held up, suspended, inverted, arrested, each find themselves divorced from both cause and effect. X and A are caught between several possible pasts and an equally possible future, albeit one deprived of all certainty. The statue is suspended between action and reaction, and the image, as it is with all cinema, is cut from its proper relational network. It is their very suspension which designates their undecidability. Divorced or suspended from their natural framework, each effectively becomes a kind of singularity. Okay, so this last section is called the mise-en-scène of two, which is a bit of a bad pun on Badiou's paper called The Scene of Two, which is his paper on love. Okay, so it's probably a little bit late to be doing this now, but nonetheless, it's probably worth saying a thing or two about Badiou's understanding of love. Here's where I head into dangerous territory. So Badiou's take on love essentially departs from the infamous Lacanian thesis, il n'y a pas de rapport sexuel, there is no sexual relation. As Badiou points out, this thesis raises a paradox, namely that although there is only a single humanity, of which we all clearly partake, there are nevertheless two positions of experience, the one masculine, the one feminine. Incidentally, it's worth pointing out here that for Badiou, as ostensibly for Lacan, masculine and feminine positions are supposed to be no way reducible to biology. Badiou's approach is, in his own words, quote, strictly nominalist. There is no question here of an empirical, biological or social distribution. Anyway, these masculine and feminine positions are, according to Badiou, absolutely unrelated, inasmuch as nothing in experience, he's underlining this, nothing in experience is the same for the positions of man and woman. Now, of course, this disjunction must be radically unknown in Badiou's terms for the simple reason that all knowledge, being necessarily situated, that is, being part of the situation, that's really his definition of knowledge, must be positioned within the disjunction itself. So, in order to say anything of sexual disjunction, we first require a supplement in the form of an event. Now, this event is, for Badiou, none other than the amorous encounter, whose trace, generally in the form of a declaration of love, invokes the void or the unknown of the disjunction, i.e. the generic statement, I love you, bringing together two fundamentally incongruous positions, I and you. And its ensuing truth is precisely the treatment of this paradox of sexual disjunction. However, this invocation of the void, which, as I said earlier, is precisely what guarantees an event's universality, so it's crucial for somebody like Badiou, is only ensured inasmuch as the trace of the event, which, as I said before, you know, maybe the statement, I love you, something like that, remains an absolute, quote, an absolutely undetermined, non-describable, non-composable term, end quote. As such, aside from being shared across two otherwise disjunct positions, the only relation this term, qua event or trace, can have is with nothing, or more precisely, the nothing, i.e. the void. To this effect, Badiou defines love, and this is his definition of love, as that which makes truth of sexual disjunction. Meaning love makes manifest in truth the fact that the world harbours two radically disjunct positions. Or again, love is what brings about the two. It's the experience and thought of what the two is. I'll say one or two more words on this idea of the two. So this two needs to be very carefully understood. For one thing, contra someone like Aristophanes, it's not the two of fusion, whereby two ultimately counts as one. Nor, for that matter, is it the two of summation, wherein 1 plus 1 equals 2. To the contrary, the law of absolute disjunction means that neither position can have any real experience of the other, hence the impossibility of their subsumption or addition, both of which would involve a kind of illegal interiorization. So in Joan Kopchak's words, quote, "the madness of love consists in the creation of a two where there never was a one and which is not itself one." For the two that is invented in love is finally an immanent two, a two counted from itself, a two which, quote, "lies in excess of that which composes it without for all that annexing the three." Or as Badiou puts it, and I'm almost done with this, "the two who amorously operate is properly the name of the disjunct apprehended in its disjunction." Meaning that prior to love, there can be no, and this is, I suppose, what he wants to get at, prior to love, there can be no real experience of sexual difference. Or again, sex is something that only comes after the event. So love, according to Badiou, is then absolute fidelity. It sounds tautological, I realise, but absolute fidelity to the sudden emergence of the two, attested to in the amorous declaration, "I love you." It unfolds in the world in the form of an amorous truth procedure, namely a material process by which the lovers reevaluate the entirety of the situation. The entirety of their lives, their whole experience, sort of traversing the world, the situation, bit by bit, according to its connection or disconnection to the nominal supposition of the two. So, numerically speaking, and this is the end part with numbers, love is the process whereby we pass from the one through the two to infinity. So returning finally to René's cinema, I think it's precisely this eventual progression, i.e. from the one to the two onto infinity, that we can see at work in last year in Marienbad. In point of fact, this real divide separating X from A is the very source of the film's mystery, a disjunction which is, of course, principally encapsulated in what Jean-François Lyotard would call their différend concerning the supposed events of the previous year, last year in Marienbad. For when we really get down to it, we see that X, whose world as narrator, at least for the most part, we effectively inhabit, we see that X has no real relationship with A, although he, of course, cannot know this. And so his is thus a persistent and, of course, ultimately hopeless persuasion, a desperate imploration that A remember him, as he puts it, as he says so many times, remember me, and concede to their relationship. Thus, time and again, X attempts to bridge the sexual divide, to prove in one way or another their apparent connection. Which is why, to pursue our earlier example, when confronted with A's refusal to acquiesce to his own interpretation of the statue, we might just go on again, sorry. X immediately attempts to surmount their opposition by observing how both explanations are entirely possible at the same time. Pronouncing, "the couple had left home and had been walking for days. They've just come to the edge of a cliff. He holds her back to keep her from the edge while she points out to the sea, stretching out to the horizon." That's a quote. Needless to say, his attempts are fruitless. There is, of course, no existing bridge to span their sexual divide, or as Badiou puts it, only a supplement can broach this disjunction. And in fact, it is only at the close of the film, when X and A finally break free of the tyranny of repetition by leaving the hotel altogether, i.e. when the event is finally decided in one way or another, that the two truly emerges, this two being attested to in the final words of the film as X recognises that A now exists seul avec moi, alone with me. Indeed, this alone with me is, I think, really the very essence of the imminent two that is love, according to Badiou, the convocation whereby the void of the sexual relation invoked in the event, this being precisely, as I've been saying, what the entirety of the film is, you know, it's what it's about, really, as far as I'm concerned. Yes, where the essence of the imminent two, that is love, this convocation whereby the void of the sexual relation invoked in the event is attested to in the opening of an amorous truth procedure. And Marienbad's ambiguous conclusion, I think, thus paradoxically marks the point where its time truly begins, where the intertime of the event finally gives way to the new eternal present, X declaring that A exists alone with me at the precise point at which they escape the hotel's eventual matrix, his final words being delivered over a distant shot of the hotel, where all that remains of its timeless Baroque artistry is a vague outline, its form barely distinguishable against the night sky.